All right. Next week we'll have next 2 weeks we'll have a couple of Christmas messages and so forth, and look forward to giving those. I had a great interaction with a former church member, and I said, you know, sometimes it's hard to prepare a Christmas message because it's the same story. It's the same passage. There aren't 40 passages on this topic. And that person goes, we want to hear the same thing all over again. Okay. We're just excited to hear the same story all over again. So, during the Christmas season of late, and I say in the last 5 years, Susan and I kind of dig through the Hallmark Christmas story, Christmas movies and stuff like that, and just watch stuff. And guess what? Every story is exactly the same, nearly exactly the same. The characters are all changed, but the storyline is pretty much the same. Do people fall in love on Christmas Day and all that jazz? But you know what? We keep watching the same movie over and over, the same stuff. Well, different characters, different title, different location. We watched The Vermont Christmas last night. Guess what? Same old story. And guess what? We loved it. I guess it's true. We don't mind hearing the same story over and over and over again. But this one's actually true. It's not a movie. Someone didn't make it up or write it in the story somewhere. It's actually true. So we'll visit that story in the next 2 weeks, Lord willing. We're in Colossians chapter 3, and we'll actually get done with chapter 3 this morning and go to chapter 4, verse 1. But our title today is Masters and Servants. And I have a sensitivity to the environment in which we live right now, critical race theory and all that jazz that's kind of leaked into our culture. It's been leaking into our culture for 50 years, and kind of saturated how we think about stuff. Probably more than 50 years. It probably goes back to the early 30s when a school of people came over to this country and started to teach in the university system, and so forth. And our topic today is in regards to some of that stuff. It kind of touches on the fringe of it a bit, but let me just give you an introduction. Today, the average person divides their day into three parts. We work for 8 hours. We sleep for 8 hours. And we goof around for 8 hours. We do whatever we want. We have free time. Or so we think. It's not true for everybody. But that's how people... That's how we divide up our day as we think about it. How does the Christian life bring meaning to this kind of existence? The people in our text today did not live that life. That was not their world at all. A person who worked as a common household slave did not work 8 hours a day, sleep 8 hours a day, and goof around for eight more. That just wasn't their life, etc. Does the Bible speak to the issue of what I do at work? I would suggest to you that Paul certainly does. He speaks to me about how I function at work. The two previous issues about the husband-wife relationship and the parents and children relationship is different. Those are the two things that happen primarily while we're not at work. What Paul talks about in this text is what do we do when we're at work? In the Roman Empire, it is estimated that as much as half the population was made up of slaves and servants, about 60 million people, some people have estimated. The Roman Empire functioned because of slaves in many respects. This group included teachers and doctors. Just because you had some kind of training didn't make you special. Many, many doctors were slaves. Many, many teachers were slaves. Were people who functioned as the servants of people who had all the money and all the wealth and all the power. If one of these people ran away, and I'll touch on that in a minute, because along with this letter to the Colossian church came a letter to a man in the Colossian church named Philemon. Along with people who ran away, they could be branded on their forehead with an F, which stood for fugitive. The Latin word for fugitive was branded on their forehead, so that you knew this person ran away before. that person could be summarily executed or at least branded. Being a slave at this moment in history was not a happy thing. It would have been difficult for the majority who found themselves in that position. Turn to the text with me just for a moment. We're going to start in verse 22. And I'll read down to chapter 4, verse 1. Slaves, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service or people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance of your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. For the wrongdoer will be paid back for the wrong he has done, and there is no partiality. Masters, treat your slaves justly and fairly, knowing that you also have a master in heaven. Paul from the Lord speaks to people who find themselves in this situation. It's interesting that the vast majority of people who read this letter fell in the category of slaves or servants. The early church was made up of huge numbers of people who came out of the working class or out of the servant class of people. Very few people in the early church came out of the class that Philemon was. He owned slaves. He owned Onesimus. And he could legally brand him with an F on his forehead or have him killed. If you want to read something interesting, read the letter to Philemon, because Paul says that's all changed because he's become a Christian. It says in, and Paul doesn't speak to this much, but listen to what Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. You might want to jot that down. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 20. Each one should remain in the condition in which he was called. That's an interesting word right there, in which he was called. Were you a bondservant when called? Do not be concerned about it. But if you can gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. For he who was called in the Lord as a bondservant is a free man in the Lord. Likewise, he who was free when called is a bondservant of Christ. You were bought with a price. Do not become bondservants of men. So, brothers, in whatever condition each was called, let him remain there with God. So Paul doesn't actually speak to the issue of slavery. He doesn't tell masters, free all your slaves, or he doesn't speak to the Roman Empire and say, this is wrong. He simply tells people who are in that situation how to live in that situation. It's an important precept to understand. Human slavery is always evil. Always. Yet Scripture speaks to a kind of slavery that is quite different than our ideas about this humanly devised relationship. Listen to what it says in Romans chapter 6, starting in verse 16. Do you not know that if you present yourselves to anyone as obedient slaves, you are slaves of the one whom you obey, either of sin which leads to death or of obedience which leads to righteousness? So Paul takes the slavery picture of a human being and a master and assigns it to sin and righteousness. I'm either the slave of sin, very negative thing, or a slave to righteousness, a very positive thing. So slavery in Paul's mind is a much bigger discussion than something between two human beings. All of us fit into the category before Christ of being a slave to sin. And when we're in Christ, we become a slave to righteousness. We don't exit slavery. We change our master. But thanks be to God that you who were once slaves of sin have become obedient from the heart to the standard of teaching to which you were committed, and having been set free from sin, have become slaves of righteousness. He explores that a little bit in that text, all the way down to verse 22. One of Paul's points in this chapter is that sin is enslaving, but the grace of God at salvation frees us to no longer serve the master of sin, but to serve the master of righteousness. As of 2018, which country do you think had the most slaves in it? Literally slaves, as we discussed in the text. India has 8 million slaves. India. Second, China, 3.9 million slaves. Third, Pakistan, 3.2 million slaves. North Korea, 2.6 million slaves. Nigeria, 1.4 million slaves. Iran, 1.3 million slaves. Indonesia, 1.2 million slaves. The Democratic Republic of Congo, 1 million. Russia, 794,000. And the Philippines, 784,000 slaves. By our definition of slaves, people who are owned by someone else and made to do whatever they tell them to do. Human slavery exists today and is always evil and driven by control. Slaves of God are those who are exposed to and serve the goodness of God and the service of a truly righteous king. At salvation, we are not free to do our own thing. We are called to submit to Jesus Christ. It's important to state that slavery was common in the ancient world and slavery of all kinds is common in the modern third world and also in corrupt first world societies. There is slavery in our society. The Bible interacts with this situation a good bit without speaking to it directly. Joseph and the children of Israel in Egypt, they were slaves there. How about periods during the Judges when they were enslaved by overrunning countries? Or how about Daniel in Babylon? He was enslaved to the people who ran the place. How about Roman and Greek culture during the ministry of Jesus? New Testament authors. I'll come to that in a moment. And Philemon. He was a slave owner. Nonetheless, slavery is contrary to a Christian worldview. The biblical worldview sees each individual as made in God's image and therefore is endowed with a value which is far above being someone else's slave. Slavery is evil. Jesus died to redeem people because they carry the image of God and they are worth that much to him. Slavery is contrary to that idea. In the 21st century world, that this can manifest itself in miserable working conditions, human trafficking, the gulags, which are still active today, sweatshops, and actual enslavement of whole people groups. The Uyghurs are a people group in China. They're ethnically Muslim, and they are enslaved, literally, as a group of people by the Chinese government. Many of them have been enslaved under the guise of offering them escape from poverty and preventing the spread of religious fanaticism. There's a group of people who practice a certain kind of meditative religion, and they are enslaved and tortured, in some cases put to death in China. People are enslaved to their work, political ideologies, and the personal pleasure of those with power. Christians have battled slavery from the beginning of time. Not all, but some. Well, what does Paul say about the relationship between a servant and their master? Paul chooses to speak to how to honor God in a culture that accepts slavery as a part of life. Do I wish Paul had spoken to the general issue of slavery? I do. Do I wish there was more verses in the Bible that spoke to the issue? I do. That's not there, so I'm not going to put it there. But Paul does speak to the issue of how do we respond when we find ourselves in an enslaving situation. And so the text only has one single verse for corrupt, evil masters, and more than that, for people who find themselves caught in slavery. Most of the text is about for those people. And so I take that to mean that he's not choosing to take a big public stand against slavery. We can figure that out for ourselves. He's choosing to take a stand on how do we function in the environment in which we find ourselves that we cannot get out of. Let me read the text one more time just so that you can get the sense of that now. Bondservants, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not with by way of eye service. And we'll talk about that word, or as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance of your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. You get the sense that there are some of us who will never work for a honest, credible employer. Possible. You may never have the privilege of working for someone who genuinely cares about their employees. Paul takes that into account. If you were a slave and your master was evil, guess what? You were permanently attached to that evil master, unless he sold you. How do you function in that environment? Well, for some of us, that's going to be easier than others, especially depending on the quality of our spirit. But how do we actually function in that environment? For the wrongdoer will be paid back for the wrong he has done, and there is no partiality. He takes the present situation and talks about it at the end of the situation, whatever that turns out to be. In the next life, that person will get their comeuppance, as we say. So let's talk about slaves and masters. There's the text we just read. The primary word in the text is obey. Look back at the text. Slaves, obey in everything. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, do you know the story of Philemon? Philemon owned Onesimus. Onesimus ran away, which means he could be executed by his master if he ever caught up with him. They didn't have the sophisticated methodology for finding people as they do today. So Onesimus got away, and he finds himself in front of the Apostle Paul all the way in the city of Rome. How that happened, that was a God thing for sure. And guess what happens to Onesimus? He receives Christ. Paul writes a letter to the church at Colossae, and he looks at Onesimus and says, you know what? I need you to give this letter to your master. And you're going back. What? Paul sends him back. And he tells Philemon, he left your slave, now he's returning as your brother. Doesn't change the situation at home. He says, if he stole money from you, and he did, I will pay it back. That's his attitude about this whole thing, which is really remarkable, I think. It's a completely different point of view. Treating people as unto the Lord who are unbelievers can be hard, whereas treating people as unto the Lord who are believers shouldn't be hard. So that's what's coming out of the Philemon story for me anyway. Either way, Paul calls masters to treat employees, servants, in this case, slaves, as unto the Lord, just and fair. We'll get to that in a few minutes. I want to begin with some observations from this little section of the text. First, the opening word, hoi douloi, means the word servant or slave, and is used to describe the Apostle Paul, the Apostle James, the Apostle Peter, Jude, Jesus' brother, John the Apostle, and Jesus. This is not for just people who are under someone's thumb. This word describes all kinds of people, including our Lord. Second, Paul uses the same word here that he used for children and to their parents in verse 20. It's the word that means to give ear to, listen, render submissive, acceptance, hear under, listen, so that you act in response to what you just heard from the person who's in charge. And then he says, in everything. That's a servant's life. It's not a suggestion, it's an imperative. Third, this command applies to earthly masters. The Greek word translated masters is the word kurios. The exact same word that's used to speak of Jesus Christ, the kurios. Fourth, Paul seems to be saying that employees, slaves, and servants have a tendency to serve a certain way. They serve while they're being watched, while they're under the master's eye. They serve so that the boss is always impressed. As men pleasers. That's what the word means. The actual Greek word translates eye slave. A slave to another person's seeing you. I know athletes who function that way. A fifth thing I see in the text, servants, slaves, and employees are challenged to serve and work sincerely from their heart or with an open heart as unto the Lord. True service is a heart issue. We'll come to that later and expand on that a bit. Paul shifts from the work of a slave for an earthly master to a slave's work as for the Lord in verse 23. And that tells me something about this thing we call work ethic. What's my work ethic? I have 18 grandkids, and I like to watch them work. Some of them are pretty small. Some of them have already manifested this incredible work ethic, and there are six. There's others who are 12 and 13. It's like, come on over here and help us. Can't you see the work? It just, we all come at that just a little bit different. We just do. So work ethic is something that we teach. I said to one of our former elders, how is it that all of your kids turn out to be workaholics? Just kind of casual conversation. How is it that all of your children turn out to be workaholics, except for one? And, that's because mom and dad are workaholics. They taught a work ethic that came out of their lifestyle. And one child says, I reject that. One more observation. Paul seems to be a bit philosophical in verses 23 and 24. We work for the Lord, and the Lord is our reward first, not our paycheck. That's an interesting concept. Here are some implications. The first one, Paul was not concerned with our status in life. Rather, he was concerned with how we used the status we have for the glory of God. Oh, he's getting to his main point with that. Another implication in there, because so many in the church were from the lower strata of society, he had the most to say to them. His comment to masters is likely for a man like Philemon, I mentioned it before. But Jesus, what did Jesus say? It's harder for a poor man to enter the kingdom of heaven than a rich man. Is that what he said? He said the exact opposite. It's much more difficult for a wealthy man to enter the kingdom of heaven because it's so hard, it's as hard as pushing a camel through the eye of a needle. So wealth has a way of getting in the way of our clear view of Jesus. It blocks our eye. We bend in front of it with our eye service, as it were. That's not always true. It doesn't have to be true, but it can be true. Paul is speaking to two situations that are common in the work environment. First, that people don't work hard unless they are being watched. And second, that owners run their businesses solely for their personal benefit. Those are two things that just naturally come out of the way we think in the world, isn't it? I was talking with somebody about a work environment, and when you check in, you take this little device and put it in your pocket. And it monitors every step you take while you're on site. So someone can watch what you're doing, literally, every moment that you're on the clock. What does that say about the owner? I don't believe anybody works 8 hours for 8 hours of pay unless I'm actually watching that person. It's like, oh my goodness. Paul wants to speak to us about that if we find ourselves in that situation. A simple conclusion for me is if those things are true about us, about the general population, they should never be true about Christians. I take these instructions to mean that I am not the sole decider of what it means to be just and fair. It's interesting because if you own the place, you get to make all the rules, plus be the judge of how you live by those rules. That's probably not what this text is saying. I know it's not. Everybody is held accountable eventually, Paul's saying. Here's my one of the conclusions from this particular. As an employee, a servant, a slave, I serve my master so that they succeed. I have honestly told that to all six of my kids. You may not like this idea, but when you get a job, your part of your job description is to help the boss succeed. I don't care if you're a firefighter, if you check people out at the cash register, or you're a medical doctor, your objective is to make sure that your employer succeeds. Well, what if he's an ugly, take advantage of his employees kind of a guy? Sorry. Maybe you shouldn't work for that person, but that's what your objective is as a believer. Your testimony says, I'm here to help you succeed. Here's the second conclusion. How I work as an employee has a direct impact on my Christian witness. It should never be my testimony that I'm a slouch and a slough and I don't do my job. I don't come to work on time. I don't work for 8 hours. I goof around and drink coffee the whole time. Whatever. That should never characterize our testimony as a person who serves in the work environment. I do not have an excuse for laziness, indifference, or shoddy workmanship. I am called by God to do my best and give proper work for agreed upon pay. This is the minimum required to maintain a Christian testimony and open the door to sharing Christ non-verbally. The text right there says these words, "Let all who are under a yoke as bondservants regard their own masters as worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and the teaching may not be reviled. Those who have believing masters must not be disrespectful on the ground that they are brothers. Rather, they must serve all the better, since those who benefit by their good service are believers and bestowed." Things that would benefit the cause of Christ and those always involve how we work for our employer and our master. Let's go to the second part of the text, verse 1, which says, "Masters, treat your slaves justly and fairly, knowing that you also have a master in heaven." Let me give you a few observations. First, the Greek words translated justly and fairly point to the character of godly supervision and leadership. It points to God. God is absolutely just. It's the same exact word as righteous. And he's absolutely fair. Absolutely. It points to God. Second, the Greek word translated treat means to hold, decide, provide for, or show yourself. Paul's point is that the way we interact with those who work for us matters. It matters greatly before God. They are not below us. They may be below us in the work environment because you're in charge and they work for you, but before God, they're not below you, he says. That's not how God sees it. They're equal with you. Third, one reason why is provided at the end of the verse. Every earthly master has a heavenly master who knows what they are doing. The word know right there is an interesting word. It means that he has full divine knowledge of what's going on inside of you as the master. Not just what you're saying and doing, but actually how you're thinking about it. I think I can manipulate these people or get them to do what I want. God knows all that stuff. I may not be able to judge the boss's motives, but I know one person who can and does. He pays attention to all that kind of stuff. There's one implication on there. There are no unaccountable leaders in any situation. In Luke 12, it says, "To whom much is given, very little is required." No, it doesn't say that. "To whom much is given, much is required." So if you're the person in charge, much will be required of you. And if you lead properly, you might be given more to lead. How about a conclusion? That's too fast. How a person uses authority and position matters in the moment and for eternity. It may hurt people now, but you're gonna regret what happens later. You don't want to pay the consequences for a bad choice in that regard now. God never gives authority or position to dominate or abuse people. It is given to display God's love. Let's move on to Ephesians chapter 6, verses 5 through 9, because Paul wrote these two letters together. let me read that text to you first. Bondservants, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart as you know Christ, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with all goodwill as to the Lord and not to man, knowing that whatever good anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether he is a bondservant or is free. Masters, do the same to them, and stop your threatening, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no partiality with him. Very similar text right here, very similar. Let me give you an illustration that's up there on the screen. A businessman once asked this question in a Bible study. How can you tell if you have a servant's attitude? And one person sitting there said, by the way you react when you are treated like one. What a great answer. You can tell if I have a servant's attitude if someone steps into the environment and starts bossing me around like I'm their slave. My mother used to say these words, who died made you the boss. I've thought those words many times to people who are telling me what to do. Who died and left you boss? That's not the right response to the person who's running the show. It reveals what's inside of our spirit when someone treats us like a slave, doesn't it? There's an implication here. Who I see myself working for has a lot to do with how I work and the attitude I have when I work. Isn't Paul saying, you don't really first work for that person right there, you work for me. They are the beneficiary. That changes my work, how I address my work. I actually serve the Lord in this role right here, and you are the personal beneficiary right now. Let me draw some conclusions and then we'll be done. First, I do not first work for a person. I serve the Lord in my work for someone. I really like that whole point. I have been in the work environment since I was 14. I worked for a giant farmer on a 1,000-acre vegetable farm. I worked for a home builder pounding nails. I bussed tables at a steakhouse when I was in college. I taught Christian school. I worked for my mother-in-law, rehabbing old houses that she had. I served as a city council member. I've been the assistant pastor at a church. I was the principal. I taught at school, and I was the principal at that